Guten Nachmittag. Herzlich willkommen zur dritten Veranstaltung. Wunderbar, dass Sie nach dem Essen den Weg wieder hier hingefunden haben. Sicher sind alle ein bisschen müde, aber ich glaube, wir werden alle wieder sehr wach werden, weil es ja um ein sehr, sehr wichtiges Thema geht in Südafrika. Das Bildungssystem ist eine Schlüsselfrage, ein Schlüsselbereich für die Entwicklung. Und ich habe auch die Ehre, wie schon den ganzen Morgen hier drei unglaublich kompetente Gesprächspartner vorstellen zu dürfen. Wir freuen uns sehr, dass Sie gekommen sind, dass Sie da sind, um mit uns zu diskutieren. Dr. Carol Bloch, sie ist aus Cape Town angereist, Leiterin von PRESA. How do you call it? PRESA oder PRESA? PRESA. Okay, PRESA, Project for Alternative Education in South Africa, eine Institution, die ist angeschlossen an die Universität von Cape Town. Sie wurde 1992 von Dr. Neville Alexander gegründet. Viele von Ihnen werden Neville Alexander kennen und wir alle haben mitgetrauert, als er vor 2 Jahren gestorben ist. Und er hat dieses Projekt gegründet, das auch Einfluss genommen hat auf die Sprachenpolitik in Südafrika, darauf, wie die Bildungspolitik im Hinblick auf Sprachen ausgerichtet werden sollte, im Unterricht und auch in der Lehrerausbildung. PRESA oder PRESA hat Lesen schon immer für sehr wichtig gehalten. Seit 2006 ist das noch mehr in den Vordergrund gerückt. Es wurden Leseclubs in Townships gegründet und in Communities, die unter Erwachsenen und Kindern, so heißt es wörtlich, die Freude am Lesen und Erzählen fördern und aufrechterhalten sollen. Ende 2012 hat PRESA Nalibali initiiert, eine nationale Lesekampagne, über die wir nachher noch mehr hören werden. Und Carol Bloch hat in all diesen Bereichen geforscht, sie hat Programme entwickelt und sie hat Kinderbücher geschrieben, Bilderbücher, wunderbare Bücher. Begrüßen darf ich auch Professor Njabulo Ndebele. Viele haben ihn vielleicht gestern Abend schon gehört. Die kürzeste wunderbare Beschreibung über Sie habe ich gelesen, die lautet: He's a leader, a teacher, a thinker. Und ich glaube, das trifft es sehr gut. Sie sind Schriftsteller, Sie sind Essayist, Publizist. Sie gelten als einer der wichtigsten Experten für das Bildungssystem in Südafrika. Sie waren von 2000 bis 2008 Vizekanzler der Universität von Cape Town und seit 2012 nun sind Sie Kanzler der Universität von Johannesburg. Und da habe ich jetzt auch nur ganz wenige Ihrer Funktionen aufgezählt, die wichtigsten, denn Sie haben viele, viele Ämter, wichtige Ämter. Ich glaube, es ist richtig, wenn ich sage, Sie sind geprägt vom Black Consciousness Movement, da, wo Sie herkommen, da, wo Sie sich politisch engagiert haben. Und Sie sind seit letztem Jahr Vorsitzender der Mandela Rhodes Foundation und der Nelson Mandela Foundation, auch zwei sehr wichtige Funktionen. Last but not least darf ich Dr. Kolela Manku begrüßen. Er ist Lehrbeauftragter für Soziologie an der Universität Kapstadt und Oppenheimer Fellow am Hutchins Center for African and African American Research der Universität Harvard. Sie kennen sich sehr gut aus, auch in den Diskussionen über Black Consciousness in den USA und können da Vergleiche ziehen, haben das auch verschiedentlich schon gemacht. Außerdem waren Sie oder sind Sie auch Kolumnist von vielen großen südafrikanischen Tageszeitungen und Kommentator für internationale TV- und Radiostationen wie CNN und BBC. Und dann habe ich gelesen, Sie sind gar nicht nur in Anführungsstrichen Soziologe, sondern auch Regionalplaner und Stadtplaner und Entwicklungsplaner. Zumindest haben Sie da auch in diesen Bereichen studiert. Also Sie sehen, wir haben sehr kompetente Gesprächspartner hier. Ich möchte vielleicht kurz zur Einführung sagen. Sicher haben Sie auch den Satz gehört von Nelson Mandela: Education is the key for a better world. Das hat er den Jugendlichen der Jugend immer wieder gesagt. Bildung sei der Schlüssel zur Freiheit und zur Teilhabe am Aufbau einer neuen Gesellschaft. Und ich glaube, wir finden diesen Satz alle richtig. Und es wurde auch viel unternommen in den ersten Jahren. 1996 wurde das Schulgesetz verabschiedet. Die Rassentrennung wurde offiziell abgeschafft. Die Mehrsprachigkeit wurde eingeführt in den Schulen nach einer breiten Diskussion. Es wurden Alphabetisierungskampagnen durchgeführt und es wurden sehr, sehr viele Pläne geschrieben. Weißbücher und Grünbücher und Programme noch und noch und noch. Professor Ndebele, Sie haben gestern Abend aufgeführt, dass schon vieles erreicht wurde, wie ich es auch gerade gesagt habe, im Bildungssystem. Und dann haben Sie gesagt, dadurch hat der Staat sich sehr früh oder auch die Regierung Legitimität verschafft durch diese schnellen Aktionen. Und dann haben Sie aber die Frage gestellt, what will it take to sustain that all? Und ich glaube, an diesem Punkt ist man. Und ich möchte vielleicht noch ein paar Fakten nennen zum Bildungssystem, damit wir die gleiche Ausgangslage haben. Sustainability ist noch nicht erreicht im Bildungssystem. Der Fakt ist, dass in ländlichen Schulen viel Infrastruktur fehlt, dass da zum Teil nicht mal sanitäre Einrichtungen sind. Manchmal gibt es sogar noch nicht mal ein Schulgebäude. In Township-Schulen fehlt Mobiliar. In Township-Schulen gibt es keine Bibliotheken und keine Labors. Es heißt, die Lehrer sind insgesamt nicht besonders gut ausgebildet in Südafrika. Manche lassen einfach Stunden ausfallen, erscheinen nicht. Und ich habe gelesen, über 10.000 Lehrer verlassen die Schulen jährlich, was natürlich eine sehr große Zahl ist. Corruption Watch, eine NGO, die Sie vielleicht kennen, spricht auch von Korruption an Schulen, dass Gelder verschwinden, dass das die Schulleiter sind oder aber auch die Lehrer, die finanzielle Mittel missbrauchen oder in die eigene Tasche stecken, dass Freunde und Bekannte mit Posten belohnt werden, versehen werden, auch in den Schulen. Und was ich besonders schlimm fand, ist wohl ein Befund, dass Schüler für höhere Punkte, also für eine bessere Leistung, den Lehrern Gefallen tun müssen, hat Corruption Watch festgestellt. Und dass Prüfungsunterlagen verkauft werden, statt dass sie verteilt werden. Das heißt also, wir haben heute ja auch schon verschiedentlich über Korruption gesprochen. Wenn das stimmt, Sie wissen das vielleicht besser als ich, dann ist das eine sehr schlimme Erscheinung, denke ich. Kurz zu den Folgen. 2013 haben nur rund 40% der Schüler das Bildungssystem erfolgreich mit einem Abschluss durchlaufen. 60% haben die Schule abgebrochen oder die Abschlussprüfung nicht geschafft. Sie wissen wahrscheinlich auch alle, dass die Jugendarbeitslosigkeit hoch ist, dass offensichtlich auch die Arbeitslosigkeit unter Graduates, also unter Menschen, die studiert haben, hoch ist. Also, welche Perspektiven haben diese Jugendlichen? Auf der anderen Seite gibt es die Schulen, die die früheren Model C-Schulen heißen. Das waren rein weiße Schulen, die aber dann geöffnet wurden und die sehr viel besser ausgestattet sind. Und es gibt private Schulen. Und wenn man die Politiker fragt, wohin schicken sie ihre Kinder, dann geben sie darauf lieber keine Antwort, weil sie wahrscheinlich alle ihre Kinder auf private Schulen schicken. Frau Bloch, deshalb die erste Frage an Sie. Kann man das so nennen, dass es ein Zweiklassensystem nach wie vor gibt im Schulsystem?
Well, I don't think it's right. No, it's not right. But it's very much there. And it was there under apartheid, a tiered system with extremes between the different systems that people were offered, and it's exactly the same. So the majority of African language speaking children have a far inferior delivery of education than do those who can afford to go into Model X, Model C, which are the ex-white English speaking schools or the private schools. Doesn't feel as if there's any sign of that changing in the near future.
Das werden wir gleich vielleicht noch weiter diskutieren. Professor Ndebele, Sie haben ja gestern auch davon gesprochen, dass zum Teil die alten Verhältnisse ja noch vorherrschen. Obwohl ganz viele Häuser gebaut worden sind, sind keine Communities geschaffen worden. Den Satz haben wir heute schon mehrfach gehört. Sie haben gesagt, die Townships sind immer noch Dormitories, also Schlafstädte. Und Sie haben gesagt, das ist ein Failure of our national imagination. Das ist heute auch schon von einer Kollegin von Ihnen gesagt worden. Es fehlen die Visionen. Welche Vision fehlt in Bezug auf das Bildungssystem? Oder woran ist es gescheitert, wenn Sie sagen Failure?
Is this on?
Yes.
I think that Maybe to add another statistic as a kind of background, is that it is said that the South African population, 65% or something of the South African population is of the age 30 and under. Now that is a very huge population of young people. And there is a, and given the statistic that you gave of 40% only making it in the matric and then going on to graduate, there is a great deal of clearly of wastage. So the issue of the unemployment of youth is partly best seen within the context of the demographic figures that I've just mentioned, which also allows one to address another interesting phenomenon, that it's very common today to find people in their 30s, between 30 and 40, 35 or so towards 40, that are running complex institutions with multi-million rand budgets and so on, are a very interesting phenomenon. But if you think that, if you consider the fact that there are people that young who are able to perform high-level complex tasks and make very big and complex decisions, that they were only probably part of the 40% that you're talking about. Consider the impact if 60% of the school going age actually made it to university. That means the country has the opportunity to have out of its graduating cohort every year at least 60% of highly gifted young people who can perform in the economy at the highest level possible. And some of those can even go into government and other areas of national life. The country is therefore deprived of a significant percentage of highly gifted people who get wasted along the line. And we cannot afford that given the challenge that our constitution has placed in our hands. So this provides you then with a context in which you can begin to talk about vision and imagination, because then there's a simple starting point, is that if 60% of your population is 30 years and under, then and that they are highly likely to get into positions of responsibility at a much earlier age than most of us, then you'd better make sure that they get the best possible education from the beginning, even before they go to school in the kindergarten or whatever, and then the primary school must be the best possible environment in which to learn. And by the time they get to secondary school, they have a good reading base, they have a good mathematical base, they have good language skills, they speak more than, they speak at least three languages that are South African languages, because it is possible those that are in enabling environments can add a fourth and a fifth, you know. So in other words, we are not, a vision therefore has to take into account these factors and then use them to formulate a system that is then responsive to the long-term needs of South Africa, and laying a groundwork from the beginning that is impeccable, strong, and rigorous, that by the time the kids leave high school, into universities, they are so well prepared. That's the first. The second thing is that you've got to have clarity of vision, and that part of the clarity of vision means that we lost an opportunity sort of to play a marketing game, but a very serious one. Consider that if in 1994 we had put in place or even talked about it, the quality of education, the level that I'm talking about, we would have been able to say the cohort of 1994, when the cohort of 94 graduates 12 years later, we say these are the products of the schooling system of the new democracy. But we didn't do that. So we are still thinking about what we could have done and what we should do, and we are not yet in the business of doing what, you know, has to be done. Just to conclude, but the part of the context against which you have to formulate the vision is considering that the situation is actually getting worse, yes, in many cases, and it's so urgent we can't wait another day.
Dr. Bloch, Sie sind ja auch oft vor Ort. Und wir lesen in den Papieren, dass 20% des Etats ins Bildungssystem gehen. Suma hat bei der letzten Regierungserklärung im Juni nochmal gesagt, es ist die allerhöchste Priorität. Warum ist es dann, sieht es so schlimm aus? Sehen Sie lokale Gründe? Versuchen Sie uns ein paar Gründe zu nennen in Ihren Augen.
Well, I think we still have teachers who were badly trained during the apartheid years. And I think Njabulo talked last night about how many teachers left the system at the beginning in 1994 and just after that. But, you know, we don't have the vision for what all of our children need. I think that's the problem. And I think what you were trying to say is that we have all these talented children, but they're being let down by the system. The system that we have in place, and there's been a lot of measures put in place to do with curriculum over the years, and a lot of mistakes have been made because the government has not taken into account the language issue and the multilingualism in South Africa. And you cannot teach children just the basics, the foundations of education in a language that they don't think and feel in, and especially when teachers are not readers, and we do have a major issue with teachers not being readers in South Africa and across the continent, in fact. And this goes back to colonialism and the language issue again, because people have been denied opportunities to grow intellectually in their own languages. When you talk about literacy in South Africa, a lot of people think of literacy as English. And in fact, you know, so there's always your own language is just a stepping stone to English. And yet, most of the teachers that we have in our primary schools, certainly, and I am generalizing, but most teachers are not that proficient in English. So the kind of education that starts getting delivered to African language speaking children is an inferior form of education, and this hasn't yet been addressed. The political will to implement a mother tongue based education system is not there. So a lot follows from this lack of care for the language situation, and then also the sort of global initiatives in curriculum really talk to a kind of a watered down version of what poor children need in African settings. And, you know, that's what my work and my colleague's work is about, trying to counter that, to say that all children are capable of great thinking and of great educational achievement, but we have to put in place the conditions that allow that for all children. So if you look at what middle-class English-speaking children have, if you realize that most little English-speaking children have been read maybe hundreds, if not thousands, of stories before they go to school. That's what African language speaking children require as well in order to compete. And we don't want to compete, but we want everybody to have the same opportunities. So there aren't shortcuts, in other words.
Wir werden gleich nochmal darauf eingehen, auf die Wichtigkeit der Sprache. Ich möchte nochmal zu den Basics kommen. Es heißt ja, es braucht ein Dorf, um ein Kind zu erziehen. Das ist ein wunderbarer Satz, der auch in ganz Afrika immer wiederholt wird. Wenn aber, wie Sie auch gesagt haben, die Mutter eigentlich abends kommt, wenn sie von der Arbeit kommt, ist es schon dunkel, dann kann sie kurz was kochen, dann sehen die Kinder sie 2-3 Stunden, dann ist sie vor Sonnenaufgang schon wieder zum Job weg, nach Johannesburg mit den schnellen Bussen, die sie schneller dahin bringen als vorher. Und die Kinder sind sich selbst überlassen. Was bedeutet Kindheit in Südafrika? Wie muss man da vielleicht umdenken, dass sich eine Haltung entwickelt, dass Kinder wirklich von Anfang an gefördert werden müssen? Wollen Sie was dazu sagen? Sie. Sie haben ja auch gefordert, dass sich die Zivilgesellschaft da engagieren muss. Müssen die Communities selber tätig werden, wenn die Schulen es nicht schaffen?
Well, thank you. Well, I'm glad you should ask that. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote a newspaper article in one of our largest newspapers called City Press on this very issue about the condition of the black child and the communities in which our children are being brought up. I made an example the Shebeens, and somebody said, it's only now that I'm not drinking anymore that I'm critical about the Shebeens. you will have situations where there's almost this mass ritual, if you like, on weekends of drinking from Friday to Saturday, nonstop. I was part of that, but no longer. And the sad part, of course, is that in the townships, this includes a lot of kids, of young people who shouldn't be in those places. I spend a lot of my time in Guguletu, just outside of Cape Town. And at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the evening, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds are running around in the streets. And you wonder, what will it take, to change the situation? So for me, having been inspired by Black Consciousness and Steve Biko, there's something that needs to happen in terms of just our own involvement as communities because the black community is in bad shape. It's in bad shape. I teach at UCT, and I often hang out in Guguletu. It's not just the unemployment that for me. It's what I would call, I suppose, the lack of cultural power. And in the sense that the very same dependency, as Professor Ndebele was saying yesterday, that prevailed under apartheid is still prevailing now, except now if people cannot be employed, we just put them on the welfare system. And we've got millions and millions of people on these social grants, which are supposed to take care of our children. So structurally, there's a problem. But for me, the foundational problem is this lack of cultural power. In the sense that, some years ago I wrote I've got a book that just came out. It's called The Arrogance of Power. And in 1998, I wrote an article. I'll just read you the first sentence. This is June 1998. It says, South Africa's transformation has been framed almost exclusively in political and economic terms. One more sentence. It is indeed worrisome that the subject of black intellectual empowerment has not received the same level of national attention and visibility as political and economic empowerment. I submit that unless the ideas of black people are part of South Africa's knowledge ideas complex, our freedom will be incomplete. Ideas do matter, and those who control ideas ultimately shape the policies that govern our lives. That was in 1998. It's now 2014. Black professors in South Africa are only 3% of the entire population. And when it comes to black women professors, it's even more disastrous. That is the lack of cultural power that I'm talking about. How could you possibly say you're governing a society, you're shaping the future, and where it matters, where ideas are being produced, you virtually have no presence. And so we'll forever and forever be dependent on what is being produced and what is being produced by our white colleagues with their own intellectual inheritance. And it's not to say that that inheritance is bad. Some of it is. But it is to say that there is something that's missing in the curriculum. And it reproduces in the minds of students, both black and white, the idea that they are, the black students, the idea that they are just consumers of ideas. They cannot really reshape the society. And in white students, it reproduces the idea that they shall forever be in these positions of power and domination. And so for me, the issues, there's been a strategic failure when it comes to education. A complete failure, and I don't want to sweeten it and make it sound any nicer. It's very bad, and I don't know how we're going to get out of it. Part of the problem, finally, is that I don't think the people who run the country, frankly, spend any time thinking about it.
Thank you. I just want to go back to the earlier when I talked about the importance of laying a good groundwork in the schooling system, even preschool. I don't want to be misunderstood to be that when I say a good groundwork, it necessarily means what comes into many people's imagination, that you will have in the classroom everything like desks and so on, which are very important. But there's something about some fundamentals. You asked the question, what is the basic things that need to be done? And the answer may come from certain kinds of schools across the country which have been performing very well, which are very poor schools in the sense that they don't have labs, that you see in the well-endowed schools, but what they do have in abundance and they reproduce every year is a good, well-run school, which has teachers are there on time. The principal is responsible, and everybody knows that there's authority in the system. Everybody wears uniform, and so on and so forth. In other words, the fundamentals for enabling an education to take place under controlled and a controlled environment, where everyone in the school is doing what they are supposed to do. There is competitiveness that I grew up with. I want to be the next number one in the classroom,
And your father was a principal.
But he's there, you know. All those things are in place. And so the peers who start from sub A to standard 5 or whatever, they are together. They're growing up together in a competitive. So you have a peer group system that lasts, you know, throughout the system. These things can be done everywhere, you know, and they can be done relatively quickly within a space of a decade or two. So it really calls for small kinds of intervention produce the biggest results. So I just wanted to make that point that when I say high quality, it doesn't necessarily mean the well-endowed with facilities, although that's very important. In fact, if you have those things, if I can start talking about a subject of mine that is very close to my heart, about boxing in the Eastern Cape, we may not leave this place because you have boxers in Tanzania who fight world-class boxers in the United States, trained in the best gyms in the world, and they beat them, you know, in the game. Very poor facilities. So it's not a rocket science, really.
Also was Sie sagen, es hängt auch von Menschen ab, es hängt auch von Personen ab, es hängt davon ab, ob sich Lehrer und Schüler und Principals und Eltern engagieren. Frau Dr. Bloch, wie sieht es aus, wenn Sie mit Ihrer Initiative, wir wollen lesen lernen, in eine Community gehen, dann gehen Sie ja nicht zur Schule. Sie gehen zu wem? Wo fangen Sie an? Finden Sie solche Personen, von denen wir reden? Treffen Sie auf Resonanz mit Ihrer Idee?
Well, you see, for me, it starts with motivation. And when we talk about little children and young children, and it starts with them having the kind of interactive role models that they need in order to be motivated and want to learn. And they want things to be meaningful, and they want them to be exciting and enjoyable. And so what we've done with our reading campaign, which is called Nalibali, which means in Xhosa, here's the story. What we're trying to do is revalue the power of storytelling and reading in our communities. So when you talk to people, well, you don't have to convince children, actually, but the school system has somehow lost sight of the importance of narrative as an educational good or an educational tool. And so children go into schooling expecting to learn by rote and just kind of do what they have to do to get through, if they're lucky enough to get through. But so Nalibali is outside. It's in the non-formal spaces. It's in community spaces. And I have colleagues working all over the country in 6 provinces where what we do is we offer people the opportunity to come to workshops to understand what it is we're talking about. And then we basically help them to have a good time around stories and books. And we have to get adults back into the mindset of enjoying a story because it's something that nurtures them, because it's something that speaks to them. And if you as an adult can find that story that speaks to you, or those stories that speak to you, you can then start to share them with children. It's very simple, actually, but it's extraordinarily profound in communities where nobody bothers to stop to say to children, here we are. We're going to be here with you every Saturday morning for 2 hours. You can depend on us being here, and we're going to make sure that when you come, you're going to understand us. We're going to speak in your languages. We're going to share stories with you. We're going to play games. We're going to sing. We're going to listen to you. We're going to listen to what you say to us. We're not just going to tell you. We're going to listen to you. And it's that kind of interaction that brings children back week after week.
Sagen Sie uns an der Stelle nochmal, warum es so wichtig ist, das in der afrikanischen, in der ersten Muttersprache zu machen. Es geht ja darum, Lese- und Schreibfähigkeit zu fördern, wo man sagt, dass auch ältere Schüler das häufig noch nicht mal darüber richtig verfügen. Also es ist ja eine absolute Grundlage. Warum muss die in der Muttersprache, in der ersten Muttersprache erfolgen?
Well, it doesn't have to be, but the fact is that if you want children to get engaged in thinking and in knowledge, they need to understand what's being spoken or what's being read. So, I mean, I grew up as an English speaker, and I always understood what was being given to me. And so I think that's the same thing that all children deserve. So if you start with your mother tongue and you add another language, it's not an either-or situation. And certainly there are lots of South African children or children in South Africa who are growing up being able to operate in a second language, in English, if it isn't their first language. But they have certain, they need to have certain things in place for that to work. And it doesn't work for in the majority of settings. So start with a language that the children understand and add other languages. That's the sort of recipe for success.
Dr. Manku, wenn Sie sagen, die Zivilgesellschaft, Sie haben eben gesagt, Sie wollen nichts beschönigen. Das Schulsystem ist ganz schlecht. Sie haben gesagt, die Zivilgesellschaft soll tätig werden. Wir haben gehört von jungen Leuten, die unglaublich fähig sind. Das ist auch meine Erfahrung. Man kann in Südafrika in jedes Township gehen, mit jedem sprechen. Man bekommt eine super gute Analyse, egal ob es eine völlig unausgebildete Frau ist, die von Social Grant lebt, oder ob man mit jungen Leuten spricht. Ich habe auch junge Leute getroffen, die gesagt haben, ich mache keine Karriere im ANC mehr, das lehne ich ab. Ich setze mich so für meine Community ein. Also es gibt diese Fähigkeiten, es gibt diese unglaublichen, das Engagement auch. Ich glaube, dass der Anti-Apartheid-Kampf auch ein Erbe hinterlassen hat. Heute bei den Protesten singen die Leute die Lieder von damals mit neuen Texten. Also es gibt auch das Erbe, gegen etwas anzugehen. Und das könnte man doch auch aktivieren oder, wie soll ich sagen, kanalisieren. Das ist ja ein super gutes Beispiel. Es gibt auch andere Beispiele, wo Abiturienten anderen Schülern dabei helfen, das Abitur zu schaffen. Denken Sie an sowas oder haben Sie andere Vorstellungen?
Of course, I mean, you know, we it takes two to tango, if you like. Of course, we have to be involved, actively involved, drawing on the best of our traditions under very difficult circumstances. I mean, you know, when we were kids, I grew up in a part of South Africa where Steve Biko comes from, and there was a tradition of, during school breaks, we would go to winter schools. That's how I got to know Neville. I was a 10-year-old sitting under a tree, and he was telling us alternative history of the Khoisan. It's like, what's this guy talking about? So that active involvement and that tradition needs to be revived. And I want to say that I am not in any way saying that people are not trying under the most difficult circumstances. People are trying. The guys I have my guns aimed at are the politicians and the government, because it is their responsibility, and they have failed us. And for me, ultimately, this is a political question. This is a political question. It's a question of, do we have the leadership with the commitment to turn things around? For the much, frankly, right? I'm a little depressed because I'm just scared sometimes that this thing is just gonna blow up in our face one day. Yeah. And if it can blow up in Syria, and if it can blow up in the Crimea, if it can blow up in other parts of the world, why won't it blow up in South Africa? Mm. You know, you have a situation where you have people sitting on the one side of the fence who are living in appalling conditions. And right across the fence, you have this largesse. And there's no sense of urgency. There's no sense of urgency on the part of government. There's no sense of urgency on the part of white people. And I want to say this to white South Africans, that it is really short-sighted to not engage with these issues of racialized inequality in this country. It is simply irresponsible. Forget the politics. Because one day our kids, all of our kids, are gonna inherit this thing. And it's gonna blow up in politically. And of course, the black politicians are too happy to send off their kids off to the best schools or out of the country. So we have in a tinder box, if you like. But we also have an incredible amount of anti-intellectualism. You know, I was when I arrived here, I was like, no wonder the Germans are having such a good life. Because I'm looking at all these cars, the Audis, the Mercedes. These are the cars we are competing to drive in South Africa, and we buy them by the load.
We have to show you some places you have not been.
And we are happy. We are happy to basically live lifestyles of this intellectual dependence, and this materialism that is eating at our communities. And we are not paying attention, it seems to me, to these issues of public values, these issues of cultural power. What would it actually mean to say that you have a meaningful political freedom? Meaningful political freedom where you can shape the ideas of the society in which you live. And unless your education is geared towards that, you might as well just forget it. Because if it's geared to anything else, it's geared to working for other people. And reproducing the inequalities that are there in the system as it exists. So it's a political question for me that has to do with how do we empower those millions and millions of people culturally and intellectually and get their leadership to make this a strategic objective. This thing of education as a strategic objective, not just a matter of sending kids to school, which is good in its own right, but there has to be some kind of strategic vision, it seems to me.
Wir haben ja am Anfang schon gehört, was zu dieser Vision passen würde. Ich glaube, Sie alle drei könnten jetzt uns genau erzählen, was gemacht werden muss. Es fehlt ja nicht an Vorschlägen. Sie selber haben 10 Vorschläge gemacht, wie man schwarze Professoren fördern kann. Das haben Sie aufgeschrieben in einem Artikel. Wahrscheinlich denken Sie nicht daran, dass die Regierung darauf zurückgreift. Aber es gibt ja Vorschläge, jede Menge. Vielleicht noch eine Frage, bevor ich noch 1 oder 2 oder 3 Fragen aus dem Publikum mit dazu nehme. Ist die Lage so hoffnungslos, wie wir es gerade gehört haben? Professor Ndebele. Please take the mic.
Oh, sorry. Yes, our conversation has been operating at shifting levels of engagement. There is the issue of the getting the politics right and the leadership issue, which is important. There is then on the extreme side, the question of at the operational level, getting the schools working and so on. And in between is the issue of cultural power that acts in both directions, and the state of the economy. I think these things, any society does not respond one-dimensionally to these problems. So if I use the there's many things happening all at once that are indicative of how the society as an organism responds to a particular problem that has occurred. So if at all there is a difficulty in getting jobs, we see a lot of people, it triggers informal trading. People, they want to, do things. My own, at one time I was teaching I was a vice chancellor at the University of the North. I was struck to find that in reaction to the what the kids might have considered poor engagement with the professors, they established an effective network of group study that on their own they didn't need professors to say start a group to study. It was a very effective network of learning beyond the formal, you know, environment. So what I think is let's take another area of cultural, in the area of culture. It's not insignificant that you're getting all kinds of traditions, cultural traditions, bubbling up to the surface. They have been repressed, you know, for a long time. And suddenly, well, some of them have been going on anyway, but now we know that things are wrong. We get the extent of the resurgence from things going wrong, like when a lot of young kids are dying in this initiation school. But those will never be stopped. They won't stop because, you know, people will just keep going. So that presents us with a challenge in how were these repressed cultures are not going to die, and now there are opportunities for them to bubble up, you know, into the surface. There will be more of them. I heard another one this today about Ugubuyisana or something like that. So I think those indicate that there is a broad reaction, a societal reaction, uncoordinated, but organic, in a sense, in that it's sort of bubbling up. Now, that is precisely the challenge of the intelligentsia. When you view this, what possibilities does this suggest to the intelligentsia in leading the reorganization of society, taking advantage of these bubbling factors that are so important, they cannot be in, and then at the same time trying to figure out how that process can work with many of the enabling features of a contemporary scientific society that have the potential, if you get that combination right, putting the country at a level, at a cutting edge level, globally, in leading a society that is bound to have, if it's working well, a tremendous impact across the entire African continent. So the challenge is in, so there's also, it's not a powerless country. I mean, even with the media, is alive. The Twitter and everything, it's alive. Their talk shows, it's alive. So there's no repressing this society's voice. So it's just to say then that the wherewithal for making it is there, but it's the challenge of leadership of all kinds, particularly of those that want to work in the political space. What is it that they are bringing into the show?
I want to quickly add to this. I mean, I have spent the past 20 years working in this space, in this intellectual space. And to get money or to get funding, there is not a single, or maybe there's one or two, black research institute in South Africa. There's Mapungubwe, and I can't think of any other. Now here you are, right? You are running a country, and you don't have a research institute. You only have one or two. And another dramatic example I like to use: not a single black person has ever written a book that I know about Mandela. Not one.
No.
Who?
Fatima Meer.
Okay, yeah. Okay, not a single African. No, I'm just using this to dramatize, right? I'm just using this. In fact, your response, Pumla, reminds me of Paulo Jordan when I said this. I said there's only one research institute. He said, no, Kolela, there's two. Give or take, right? The fact of the matter is, it's a disastrous situation. And unless, you know, I was saying to Pumla yesterday that I was looking at this institution here yesterday. I was saying, isn't it wonderful? I mean, here are all these folks dressing up, right, going out to listen to ideas and to engage in ideas. It's a dream that some of us have been having in South Africa for the past 20 years. But it just doesn't exist. It doesn't exist because, well, the government doesn't give a hoot. The rich billionaires don't give a hoot. And at the end of the day, you have a society that is completely, completely, in terms of just cultural and intellectual power, has got no institutions, has got no resources to actually articulate and develop its own visions. To me, that is a fundamental, fundamental problem. So I'm sorry if I close on a depressing note, but it's the truth.
Okay. I want to close on a positive note.
Thank you.
You know, children are the future. It's trite, but it's true. And when communities take initiative, as I and my colleagues see happening now a lot in South Africa around their children's future, when parents get involved in these story sessions and reading clubs, it's not that they necessarily are fluent in what they need to do, but they want to do it. There are young men and women, African men and women, all around South Africa who are desperate to get involved, who really are keen, who are driven to do something good and hopeful for the future of South Africa. What our challenge is getting people, ordinary people, just the ordinary people, and even ordinary academics, ordinary people who've had opportunities to know how to read with children, to know what books to read, to know about this literary space, to actually get involved. And that is one of our biggest challenges. That's one of my biggest challenges running Nalibali, because there are people out there who are desperate for this to be happening, but we need more able people who have the background, who have the repertoire of stories, to come and join, and particularly African language speaking people, because the role models for children are there, and every week that passes and there isn't a person there in the reading club sitting with a group of children is a lost opportunity. So I don't think there's ever any particular point at which this starts happening. It's now, and the children are there now, and they want to become critical thinkers. They don't want to go through a schooling where they just never get a chance to express an opinion or a view about anything, which is what our education system increasingly seems to do to them. So we've got to open up those spaces outside of school. And one very positive thing, I hope, that has happened is that the education department has now come to us and is asking for help to start reading clubs. And it's kind of it's an irony, but it's hopeful, because it's ironic that they are recognizing that the teaching, the curriculum is not getting children learning to read and write, and that they're coming to a sort of a non-formal organization to help create this literacy. But it is happening. So that is a hopeful sign.
Thank you very much. Ich glaube auch, dass es eine gute Mischung ist, die Sie repräsentieren. Denn es braucht ja so kritische Stimmen wie Sie, die auch einfach draufhauen und sagen, da fehlt dies und jenes und das brauchen wir unbedingt. Und ich denke, diese Regierung braucht auch so starke Worte, um überhaupt sich vielleicht in Bewegung zu setzen. Auch wenn wir heute Morgen ja schon gehört haben. Wir haben ja auch heute Morgen gehört, dass die Zustimmung zu dieser Regierung gerade auch unter jungen Leuten ja gesunken ist. Ich möchte aber Sie noch bitten für ein Schlusswort, und ich kann jetzt leider keine Fragen mehr dazu nehmen, denn wir müssen heute jetzt diese Veranstaltung leider ganz pünktlich beenden. Vielleicht können Sie nachher die einzelnen Leute hier fragen noch. Ja, bitte. Ich möchte nur noch mal einen Begriff, den Sie gestern benutzt haben, aufnehmen, vielleicht für das Schlusswort. Sie haben ja gesagt, es geht gar nicht mehr um Schwarz und Weiß. Es geht um Multiethnizität, um Multikulturalität, die Sie auch in den Townships finden und wo Sie denken, dass die ja schon eigentlich historisch schon gewachsen sind. Gibt es da einen Anknüpfungspunkt für das, was man dem schlechten oder dem miserablen Bildungssystem entgegensetzen kann? Habe ich mich verständlich ausgedrückt?
No, well, actually, there's a broader context to reaching that position of a statement that contrasts a very almost exclusive focus on race and racism as a driver of the future. And I think it may be a driver of our understanding of the past, but how you frame a conversation for the future based on entrenched modes of thinking that no longer allow other possibilities of thinking about South Africa is to go down into a tunnel that from which we may not come up even as we think we are trying to come out. And so what I was trying to frame were possibilities that are underexplored, like the cultures that are bubbling up, the cultural practices that are bubbling up, and urban types of urban awareness and consciousness that are far more complex than the race issue is actually able to explain and encapsulate. And that, in fact, if we were able to understand that more, then we will see the true perspective, the proportionally of where race actually belongs in the total scheme of things. So the one sort of positive thing that I wanted to mention in addition to that is that in addition to the things that I've read about recently, the Mailand Guardian started about a couple of years ago to come up with a project finding 200 young people. It's extraordinary, the things that these people are doing. Many young people outside of the 200 that got mentioned are starting things. They are starting companies. They are starting various projects in social entrepreneurship. When we interview young students who want to get the Mandela Rhodes scholarship, practically 80% of them want to start something. So, in other words, there is a recrudescence of a desire to be engaged in changing the society that they have inherited, and it's an energy to work with, because it's there, and needs the kind of leadership that we are talking about. So I think that in the final analysis is how these forces that are occurring lead to communities across the country reacting in an organized, organic fashion to recreate their lives at that level, coming back to the notion of it takes a child, it takes a village to bring up a child. There are possibilities. In fact, the constitution, when to the extent that I understand it, when the country was three tiers of governance, the national, the provincial, and the local, the intention was that the local is where the work was going to be happening, but it you know, now the local is not getting the leadership that is constitutionally required. Oversight, the oversight is not happening. So things are sort of chaotic at the bottom, even at the provincial level. So we've got the framework, but we need the human energy and intelligence and imagination to make it happen. I think the fundamentals for making it so are there, but we have to put it together.
Thank you very much. Das war, glaube ich, ein sehr gutes Schlusswort. Liebe Ruth, ich darf Ihnen vorstellen, da vorne sitzt Ruth Kadali. Sie hat eine große Frage und sie kann nicht mehr so gut laufen. Und sie ist eine unserer größten und ältesten Mitglieder in der Anti-Apartheid-Bewegung gewesen. Wenn du dich gleich an jemanden, du kannst ja sagen, an wen du die Frage stellst, wir müssen leider das Podium beenden. Oder? Darf sie noch? Okay, wir machen eine Riesenausnahme.
Na, Entschuldigung, ne? Aber es ist so für mich persönlich sehr wichtig. Es gibt diese fantastischen Analysen und auch genau weiß man, was zu tun wäre und diese ganzen Bestrebungen und Einsätze, die ihr leistet auch. Aber ein Basisfaktor wird übersehen und den muss ich unbedingt noch reinbringen. Und das ist die weit verbreitete Unterernährung der Kinder und Jugendlichen. Und dass wir wissen alle, was für negative Konsequenzen für die mentale, geistige und physische Entwicklung von Kindern und Jugendlichen Unterernährung hat. Und Bischof Tutu durch seine Initiative erkannte einen Biochemiker in Johannesburg und vor Jahren, es ist ja schon 5 oder 6 Jahre her, hat dieser Biochemiker, das war der Auftrag von Bischof Tutu, ein Zusatznahrungsmittel erstellt, kreiert, was auch ganz affordable ist, ein Energy Pub. Und das ist vorgekochter Mais mit Zusatz von Soja und eine Kombination von ganz wichtigen Vitaminen und Mineralien. Und wenn man eine Portion am Tag davon isst, dann ist das, als ob man ein 5-Gänge-Menü zu sich genommen hätte. Und die Jugendlichen und auch die andere Bevölkerung an der Basis hat zum ersten Mal bekommen die wichtigen Mineralstoffe,
liebe
und
Ruth,
Vitamine.
Liebe
und
Ruth, ich muss dich leider unterbrechen.
Nein,
ich finde es gut, dass wir das jetzt erfahren.
Nein, ich wollte nur sagen, es ist Schulspeisungen gemacht worden.
Sie ist immer schon so gewesen, immer
schon. Schulspeisungen wurden gemacht. Ne? Und mit dem Resultat, dass die Kinder, die sonst auch zum tagelang nicht zur Schule gehen konnten, aus Schwäche, weil sie nichts zu essen hatten oder unterernährt waren, regelmäßig zur Schule kamen und die Examensnoten hatten sich verbessert. Und das ist doch ganz wichtig.
Ja, das ist, ich finde es super gut, dass wir diese Information jetzt noch erhalten. Und wer immer von Ihnen gleich, ihr vielleicht noch antworten möchte darauf, das wäre ja bestimmt auch gut. Nur können wir jetzt hier oben die Antwort nicht mehr abwarten. Ich glaube, das ist richtig so. Also nochmal ganz herzlichen Dank für das breite Spektrum, was wir hier gehört haben. Auch für die paar Hoffnungsschimmer, die wir gehört haben. Ich glaube, das kann vielleicht auch gleich noch mit aufgegriffen werden in der Diskussion über Kultur, denn es ging ja um kulturelle Kraft. Und hier sitzen ja viele Menschen, die im kulturellen Bereich arbeiten. Vielen Dank, dass Sie mit dabei waren und bleiben Sie hier. Es gibt gleich noch eine weitere spannende Diskussion. Dankeschön.